His name was Oscar Fingal O'Flattery Wills. He became one of Ireland's foremost dramatists, wits, and poets. He said, "Nothing is so dangerous as being too modern. One is apt to grow old-fashioned quite suddenly." He wrote this in An Ideal Husband, his comedy which disproved its own epigram by becoming a successful film more than 50 years after it was written. He also declared in The Picture of Dorian Gray the principle which he lived by and which destroyed him. There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. He was born in Dublin, the son of a blue stocking poetess and of a distinguished ear surgeon whose life was overshadowed, like his son's, by a trial for a sexual offense. As a young man, he conquered London by a combination of arrogance and wit, and with a glitter which was often pure gold. There, too, he cut his name down to Oscar Wilde, a name which is destined to be in everyone's mouth, must not be too long. It comes so expensively in the advertisements. And so on today's program of Kaleidoscope, we look not so much at the life and times of the man, his troubles and his personal life, but rather of what the man said. For if nothing else, he was the world's wittiest talker. Today, on Kaleidoscope, a story of a great humorist, Oscar Wilde. The great humorist was born in Ireland in 1856. He was the most richly fanciful, fast-minded, recklessly witty, and withal most amiably joyous of modern men. So at least, he was remembered by his friends. One distinguished critic called him the greatest self-consciously deliberate master of the art of conversation who has talked the English language. He always said the right thing at the right moment, instead of thinking it up the next morning and wishing he had said it. No other man has ever been so widely quoted. Duty is what we expect from others. I can resist everything except temptation. I must decline your invitation owing to a subsequent engagement. Women love us for our defects. If we have enough of them, they will forgive us everything, even our superior intellects. I beg your pardon, I didn't recognize you. I've changed a lot. Oscar Wilde's conversation was not a monologue. He was an alert and energetic listener, and made it an art to guide the conversation in such a way as to bring out the best in the minds of others. He never talked of his own affairs except to intimates, never laid down the law, never contradicted, never pretended to be an authority on anything, except occasionally, on manners. It is written of Oscar Wilde that he was always a considerate man, would join heartily in a laugh against himself, was generous beyond the common run. Indeed, his money flowed away as freely as his thoughts. What he was too lazy to do for himself, he would do instinctively, and not from a sense of duty, for someone else. was perhaps the only great wit so tender-hearted that even for a laugh he would not hurt people's feelings. Even for a laugh he would not use coarse language. In his most hilarious flights of fancy, he remained both kind and delicate, and often his maxims were deeply in earnest. None more so than the remark that humanity takes itself too seriously. That is the original sin. He also stated, the tragedy of old age is not that one is old, but that one is young. There is a luxury in self-reproach. When we blame ourselves, we feel that no one else has a right to blame us. It is the confession, not the priest, that gives us absolution. Oscar Wilde was serious, too, in his passion for beauty, and led almost a crusade in its behalf against the negative moralists of the Victorian era. He also saw the immense theatrical possibilities in this conflict between a healthy sense of beauty and a morbid sense of sin. And being, like most humorists, a natural-born showman, he played it up in a manner that would have done credit to Billy Rose, P.T. Barnum, or David Merrick. While still in college, he asserted that reform in dress is much more important than reform in religion. And when he came down to London town after graduation, he carried a pair of pale lavender gloves and described himself as a professor of aesthetics. He would turn up at evening parties dressed in a velvet coat edged with braid, knee breeches, black silk stockings, a soft loose shirt with wide turned-down collar, and a large, flowing, pale green tie. He adopted the lily and the sunflowers, the symbols of his cult, not because of their beauty, but because they looked ludicrous in a big man's buttonhole. Oscar Wilde was big in every way, and also he was big with a powerful run of nerve. He could back up his tastes against all comers, whether they came singly or in a bunch. At Trinity College in Dublin, a notorious roughneck, the bully of the college, sneered at one of his poems, and Oscar walked across the classroom and socked him in the jaw. A battle was arranged, and to everyone's surprise, the poet knocked the roughneck cold. Later at Oxford, some of his classmates decided it would be necessary in defense of the commonplace to invade his room and smash his beautiful furnishings. Four intoxicated heroes burst into his rooms, the others watched from the stairs. The first intruder promptly rejoined his companions with the aid of Oscar's boot. The second got a punch that doubled him up on top of the first. The third made his return journey through the air, and the fourth Oscar carried to his rooms and buried him beneath a pile of furniture. Then he invited the spectators, now pro-Oscar Wilde, to a man to sample his liquor. While still at Oxford, he was once still climbing, at considerable danger to himself, from one box to another in a music hall in order to invite the occupants to a party he was giving after the show. But he was too lazy to use his athletic prowess except for self-defense or fun. "I'm afraid I play no outdoor games," he confessed later, "except, yes, maybe dominoes. I have sometimes played dominoes outside French cafes." No small, frail, or physically timid man, however, could have put on a show like Oscar Wilde did. By sheer arrogance combined with that sublime gift of witty merriment, he made himself famous on two continents at the age of 27, without ever publishing a line that anyone would bother to read. He was not a handsome man, except for his luminous eyes and fine brow. He had disorderly teeth and a rather waxy complexion. His handshake was flabby, and his powerful muscles didn't look like muscles. They looked like flesh. He lacked lines and angles, and there was something excessive in his appearance, which reminded one man of an enormous doll. These qualities frequently repelled people at first, as did the title he assumed, the Great Man of Aesthetics. But his golden voice and lyrical, unaffected laughter, and the incredible stream of gay tales, jests, fancies, parables, proverbs, and profound reflections that flowed so miraculously out of his mouth soon drowned this feeling. People gravitated to him when he entered a room and began to talk. Nothing succeeds like success was his motto, and he applied it not only to his getup, but to his remarks. On being asked how he spent the day, he said solemnly, "I was working on the proof of one of my poems all morning, and took out a comma. In the afternoon, I put it back." One day a humble little man came to his door and said, "I have called about the taxes." "Taxes? Why should I pay taxes?" Wilde replied with majestic indignation. "But sir, you are of the household here, are you not? You live here, you sleep here?" "Ah, yes, but you see, I sleep very badly." Going into a florist's shop, he requested the attendant to remove some flowers from the window. "With pleasure, sir. How many would you like to have?" "Oh, I don't want any, thank you. I just asked to have them removed from the window because I thought they looked tired." Yes, Oscar Wilde was putting on a show, and he knew quite well the effect these poses were having. Hearing a passerby say, "There goes that bloody fool Oscar Wilde," he remarked to his own companion, "It's extraordinary how soon one gets known in London." He was soon known in America, too, and the inevitable lecture tour took place in 1882. Although he had broke the heart of his impresario by refusing to carry a lily down Broadway, he put enough excess into his costume and enough wit into his remarks to reporters so that the tour was a brilliant success. No publicity stunt ever brought more copious results than the three words Wilde spoke at the pier when asked by a customs official if he had anything to declare. Said Oscar Wilde, "Only my genius." Wilde's tour of America was a sort of retaliation to Mark Twain's tour of Europe. Mark Twain, in Innocents Abroad, had laughed, an uproarious laugh, at Europe's supercilious culture. Wilde laughed the same laugh at America's lack of culture. "If American life is one of long expectoration," he said, "it must be true." The habit in America of hanging pictures up near the cornice struck me as irrational at first. It was not until I saw how bad the pictures were that I realized the advantage of the custom. The crude commercialization of America, its indifference to the political side of things, are entirely due to the country's having adopted as its national hero a man who, according to his own confession, was unable to tell a lie. On receiving a wire from Griggsville, "Will you lecture us on aesthetics?" Wilde replied, "Begin by changing the name of your town." At his lecture in Cambridge, 60 Harvard boys marched in and took seats in the front row, dressed in knee breeches, and each carrying a sunflower or lily. Wilde, getting wind in advance of this demonstration, appeared on the platform in evening clothes. It made the boys look a little foolish, and his remark that he seemed to see certain signs of an artistic movement in the lecture hall was greeted with laughter by the audience. His epigram, "Caricature is the tribute that mediocrity pays to genius," brought down the house. Cruder attempts to spoil the act of the great man fell equally flat. He was plied with alcohol by red-blooded he-drinkers all the way from New York to San Francisco. In all cases, he drank everyone into a stupor, and after piling them into a cab, sauntered blithely home to his hotel. The miners of Colorado entertained him at the bottom of a gold mine. Wilde admired the miners and described them as the best-dressed men in America. In the mine, he said, "We sat down to a banquet, the first course being whiskey, the second course, whiskey, and the third, whiskey." The miners were hauled up at dawn practically unconscious, while Wilde chatted away affably as though at a tea party in London. Having achieved world fame and a mint of money, Oscar Wilde got tired of play acting and decided to see if he could stand a little work. "The Oscar of the first period is dead," he declared on returning from America. "The second Oscar has nothing in common with the gentleman who wore long hair and carried a sunflower down Piccadilly. Anyone could have done that. My achievement was to make the whole world believe I had." His brief experiment with work began in the editorial chair of a magazine called Woman's World. He enjoyed part of the job immensely, that which consists of leaning back in the chair and talking to prospective contributors. Still more, he enjoyed meeting these contributors at the Café Royal. This seemed simpler on the whole than going up to his office. He lived up to his own maxim, "Never put off till tomorrow what you can do the day after." As to answering letters, he avoided that on principle. "I have known men come to London full of bright prospects and seen them complete wrecks in a few months through a habit of answering letters." As an editor, Oscar Wilde lasted just about a year. His next effort to do something besides talk was on the Pall Mall Gazette as a critic. But here another failing blocked him. He was too kind-hearted to hurt an author's feelings. The bitterest thing Wilde ever said as a critic was a tribute to the brilliant but egotistical American painter James McNeill Whistler. "That he is indeed one of the greatest masters of painting is my opinion. And I might add that in this opinion Mr. Whistler himself entirely agrees." Thank you. any rate, this was the beginning of a battle of wits in which Whistler scored on the champion a hit that became famous. At an exhibition of Whistler's paintings in London, an art critic of the Times was expressing his opinion that one work was good, another bad, and so on. Whistler said, "My dear fellow, you must never say this painting is good or that one bad. Good and bad are not terms to be used by you. But you may say, I like this, or I don't like that, and you will be within your rights. Now come and have a drink. That's one thing you are sure to like." "I wish I had said that," Wilde exclaimed with generous delight. "You will, Oscar, you will," replied Whistler. Well, Oscar Wilde evened the score later by remarking that Mr. Whistler always spelled art with a capital I. Wilde's heroic efforts to get down to work were made necessary by one commonplace thing that happened to him. He fell in love and got married. His bride was rich enough to keep him in food and lodging, but her income was not quite up to his motto. "Give me the luxuries, and I can dispense with the necessities." Constance Wilde was a beautiful girl and as gifted with silence as her husband was with talk. "I love her," he said, "because she never speaks, and I am always wondering what her thoughts are like." To judge by the one case on record in which she did speak, her thoughts were not much like his. She was very religious and had been expressing a fervent emotion about missionaries. He said, "Missionaries, my dear, don't you realize that missionaries are the divinely provided food for destitute and underfed cannibals? Whenever cannibals are on the brink of starvation, heaven, in its infinite mercy, sends them a nice, plump missionary." "Oh, Oscar," Constance said, "you cannot surely be in earnest. You can only be joking." The proper basis for marriage is a mutual misunderstanding, Wilde used to say, and his own marriage was for many years a successful one. He had two sons whom he adored, and because of the fabulous stories that poured out of him, they regarded him as perfect. It was out of his love for them that Wilde's real career as a writer began. Began to talk about a highly successful idea, and the idea that he would become a highly successful dramatist. The London stage of the 90s saw one after another of his successes. Lady Windermere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, An Ideal Husband, and The Importance of Being Earnest, in which he combined style and stylishness as they had never been combined since the 17th century. His plays brought him sudden wealth, and he indulged what he called that inordinate passion for pleasure, which is the secret of remaining young. Not all his epigrams had a core of truth, but when, in A Woman of No Importance, Lord Illingworth said, "The book of life began with a woman and a man in a garden," and Mrs. Allenby replied, "It ends with revelations," Wilde's mutatis mutandis was being prophetic, since his own paradise was to end in revelations of the blackest kind. An equivocal and extravagant friendship with Lord Alfred Douglas led to an action in 1895 with his father, the Marquess of Queensberry. In this, Wilde was compelled by the merciless cross-questioning of Sir Edward Carson, whose hard facts he thought he could dissolve with bright epigrams, to admit to quite unequivocal relations with a number of shabby young men. This famous trial was a turning point in English cultural history, It was the end of the 90s and of the cult, which had been invaluable to a certain degree of art for art's sake. Wilde disappeared to prison, and his plays went out of production. In the Ballad of Reading Ill, a great poem, and De Profundis, he expressed both his contrition and his anger with Lord Alfred Douglas, and when released, he retired to France, where his last days made it clear that both his contrition and his anger had been nominal. That first substantial book, and many will always think his best, was a volume of tales published when he was 32. When written down, these tales were not quite so good, according to his friends, as when he first excitedly told them to the boys. But even so, they were the finest things of the kind in the English language. In 1891, Oscar Wilde, almost 36 years of age, and still had not found the obvious way to turn his genius for conversation into literature by writing plays. His first play, Lady Windermere's Fan, was published in 1892. It was little more than an ingenious stringing together of witty things he remembered saying, but its success was instantaneous and enduring. Wilde had hit his stride at last, and by 1894, when he wrote his masterpiece, The Importance of Being Earnest, he was the most popular playwright in London and one of the famous writers of the world. More copies of his works are sold today on the continent of Europe than of any other English author except Shakespeare. Please press fast forward, let tape expire, turn cassette or tape over for part two of our presentation on the visual sounds entitled The World's Wittiest Talker. Drifted into weeks, the weeks drifted into months and years. He had lived 40 of these years, and never, according to his friends, a single unhappy day. And then something baneful happened. No one knows exactly what. Perhaps it was success. He himself had said, "In this world, there are only two tragedies. One is not getting what one wants, and the other is getting it. The last is much the worse, The last is a real tragedy. Those who knew him and those who studied his life do not know what caused the tragedy. It may have been emotional, it may have been physical. But Oscar Wilde grew coarse and pudgy. He gave loose rein to a perverted tendency which had not, up to the last years, prevented him from living a normal and wholesome life. His last 4 years were among the most tragic and piteous in the history of English literature. They were years of shame, imprisonment, exile, poverty, and worst of all, they were years of silence. And then, as the only refuge from his broken spirit, death. "I am dying," he said at the end. "I am dying beyond my means." In his life and his writings, he had already taken paradox to the unforgettable limit, and his feelings of being modern seems likely to become not old-fashioned, but immortal. It's been stated that the story of his last words, "I am dying beyond my means," has been told and mistold many times. It should be read with the very truth of those interested in human character and destiny. But it should not be overplayed. We should no longer allow it to cast back a lurid and morbid light on those 40 years of a man's life, a man who suffered inwardly, but brought to the rest of the world joy and kindness and generosity, and indeed an inimitable wit. His name, Oscar Wilde. Nothing is so dangerous as being too modern. One is apt to grow old-fashioned quite suddenly. There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. Humanity takes itself too seriously. That is the original sin. The tragedy of old age is not that one is old, but that one is young. There is a luxury in self-reproach. When we blame ourselves, we feel that no one else has a right to blame us. It is the confession, not the priest, that gives us absolution. Duty is what we expect from others. I can resist everything except temptation. I must decline your invitation owing to a subsequent engagement. I beg your pardon. I didn't recognize you. I've changed a lot. So said Oscar Wilde. And today on Kaleidoscope, we have taken a look at the paradoxical and sensational genius, a man who became the world's wittiest talker. You have been listening to the visual sounds of Mike Worf, our presentation, The Life and Times, as well as the work of a program entitled The World's Wittiest Talker, The Life of Oscar Wilde. There are other programs in the visual sound series that concern men of letters, art, and music. Please look under the outline title A for further programs on these subjects. In our library of over 500 selections, in the Visual Sounds Library.